You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2. The National Socialist Movement. 2. The March to Coburg in October 1922. A number of racialist associations intended to hold a German Day welcoming Coburg. I received an invitation with a note that they wanted me to bring along some supporters from my party. I received this request about 11 o'clock in the morning, and it came at a very opportune time. The arrangements had been made within an hour. For my supporters, I designated 800 men of the SA who were to be transported in 14 groups by a special train from Munich to the village that only recently joined Bavaria. Similar orders were sent to the Nationalist Socialist SA groups that had been formed in other cities along the route. It was the first time that a train of this sort travelled in Germany. At each place where new SA men boarded, the transport attracted great attention. Many had never seen our flags before, and they were very impressed. When we assembled at the station in Coburg, a representative of the festival committee for German Day received us and gave us a signed order which said it was an agreement by the local organisations, which meant the Independent Party and the Communist Party. The agreement said that we would not be allowed to enter the city with our flags waving. We would not be allowed to play music. We had brought our own band of 42 men, and we could not march through the streets in a group or closed ranks. I immediately dismissed these disgraceful conditions, and did not hesitate to express to those gentlemen of the festival committee who were present how astonished I was that these kind of arrangements had been made, and that it was disgraceful they had come to any agreement with these people. I explained that the SA would immediately march in company formation through the city, and it would be to the sound of music with our flags waving. And that is what happened. There were already thousands of howling, hooting people to receive us at the depot. Murderers, bandits, robbers, criminals were some of the pet names that these outstanding founders of the German Republic graciously showered on us. The young SA maintained themselves in perfect order. The squads of 100 assembled on the square in front of the railway station and at first ignored the abuse. We were unfamiliar with the city streets, so the marching procession was directed by a nervous police escort into the Hofbrauhaus cellar near the centre of the town, instead of to our quarters on the outskirts of Coburg, like we had previously arranged. On both sides of our troop procession, the noise of the masses constantly increased. The last squad had barely turned into the courtyard of the beer garden when large crowds, making deafening shrieks, attempted to rush after them. To avoid a confrontation, the police closed the gates. We could not tolerate this situation, sealed in with everyone hollering. So I told the SA to reassemble. I admonished them briefly for breaking ranks and demanded that the police open the gates immediately. After a rather long hesitation, they complied. We marched back the way we came to reach our quarters, and there we finally had to face the mob. After they were unable to disturb the squads using shouts and insults, the representatives of the true socialism, equality, and brotherhood started throwing stones. Our patience was at an end. For 10 minutes we attacked furiously on both sides. 15 minutes later, nothing red was to be seen on the streets anymore. At night, there were more serious attacks. Patrols of the SA had found members of the National Socialist Party who had been attacked and mutilated when they were alone. After that, we quickly took care of our opponents. By the following morning, the Red Terror Coburg had suffered under for years had been smashed. With typical Marxist Jew style, they passed out falsehood-filled flyers and tried to rally the members of the International Labourers into the streets by distorting the facts, saying that our bands of murderers had begun a war to exterminate the peaceful workers in Coburg. At 1:30, the great demonstration of the people was to take place, and according to the flyers, it was hoped that tens of thousands of workers from the area would be present. I was determined to put an end to this Red Terror once and for all, so I had the SA assembled at 12 o'clock. The SA now numbered nearly 1,500. I marched with them to the Coburg Fortress across the large square where the Red demonstration was to take place. I wanted to see if they would be so foolish and attempt to assault us again. As we entered the square, there were only a few hundred present instead of the announced 10,000. As we approached, they remained quiet, although some ran away. There were a few Red troops present who came from outside of the city, and as yet did not know what to expect from us. Occasionally they tried to renew hostilities, but any desire to do so was quickly taken away from them. As we watched during the speeches, we could see that the population, which was previously so intimidated, slowly awoke, took courage, and ventured out this time to greet us with shouts. When we left in the evening and marched back through the streets, they broke out in spontaneous, loud rejoicing at various places along our route. When we arrived at the train station, we were suddenly told that the workers refused to run the train for us. At that, I informed a few leaders of the mob that if this was the case, I would seize any Red big shots I could find and that my men would operate the train ourselves. I would also take along a few dozen brothers of international solidarity in the locomotive, the supply car, and in each passenger car. I made it very clear to the gentlemen that a trip managed by our own forces would naturally be a very risky journey, and that it was quite possible that we would all break our necks. I let them know it would be a pleasure to enter eternity accompanied by the Red gentleman who advocated equality and fraternity so highly. After that dissertation, the train left very punctually and we arrived in Munich safe and sound the next morning. For the first time since 1914, the equality of citizens before the law was restored in Coburg. Today, some ninny of a higher official may claim that the state protects the lives of its citizens, but it was not true at that time. The citizens had to defend themselves against the representatives of the Republic State. It was impossible at first to see the full significance of this day. Since the SA was victorious, they were more self-confident and had more faith in their leader's judgment. Also, the people began to take a greater interest in us, and many recognized for the first time that the National Socialist Movement was an institution that probably would one day be used to put the appropriate finishing touches on this Marxist madness. Only the Democratic Party groaned, complaining because we had not peacefully allowed our skulls to be crushed, but that we instead dared, in a democratic republic, to strike back against a brutal attack with fists and sticks, instead of with pacifist songs. The privileged class press was half pathetic and half vulgar. Only a few decent papers welcomed our defeat of the Marxist pirates in at least one city. In Coburg itself, part of the Marxist workers who were simply misled previously in their ideals had been taught by the fists of the National Socialists that we were also fighting for ideals. Experience proves that a person only fights for something they believe in and love. Without a doubt, the SA benefited the most from the events at Coburg. It grew rapidly. On the first party day, January the 27th, 1923, nearly 6,000 men took part in the dedication of the flag. For the first time, the companies were dressed in their new uniforms. The experiences in Coburg demonstrated how essential it was to have a unique uniform for the SA. This not only strengthens the morale, but also helps our men identify each other in a dispute, which means they can avoid mistakes when it comes to recognizing comrades. Up to this point, the men simply wore armbands, but now a uniform coat and the well-known cap were added. The experiences in Coburg were also significant because it made us determined to systematically break the Red Terror that prevented meetings of opponents in many places for years, and to ultimately restore the freedom to hold public meetings. From then on, the National Socialist Battalions assembled in Red strongholds and gradually throughout Bavaria. One Red citadel after another fell victim to the Nazi propaganda. The SA began to understand its task better and better, and it moved farther and farther from the character of an aimless and lifeless defense group. They had risen, transforming themselves into a living organization that was fighting for the establishment of a new German state. This path of development lasted until March 1923. Then an event happened which forced me to alter the course of the movement and to institute some changes. 3. The occupation of the Ruhr during the first months of 1923 by the French was greatly significant in the development of the SA. Even today it is not possible or in the interests of the nation to not talk or write about it publicly. I can only speak of what has been touched on in public discussions already. The occupation of the Ruhr did not come as a complete surprise to any of us. It did, however, give rise to the justified hope that from now on, once and for all, the cowardly policy of submission would end and the National Defense Forces would be given a job to do. The SA at that time already numbered in the many thousands of powerful young men, and they could not help but participate in this national service. In the spring and summer of 1923, its transformation into a military fighting organization was completed. The later developments in 1923 can be mostly traced back to this transformation and how they affected our movement. The developments in 1923 are discussed in detail in another section, but I want to state here simply that the transformation of the SA at that time to assume active resistance against France would have been harmful regarding how it affected the movement if our assumptions about why this restructuring was needed were flawed. The end of 1923 may initially appear as an awful event, but when we look at it from a higher point of view, we see it was a necessity. With a single blow, the transformation of the SA into a military unit was ended. The SA was made harmless by the arrogance of the German government's actions, and this weakening of the SA in turn damaged the movement. However, this change opened the possibility for us to rebuild one day, and where once we were forced to abandon the correct course, we could now follow a new path. The NSDAP was refounded in 1925. It must set up, develop and organize the new SA according to the principles originally established. It must return to those sound principles, and it must again regard its highest duty to be the development of the SA as an instrument of strength in the fight for the philosophy of the movement. It must not permit the SA to sink to the level of a militant defense unit or secret organization. It must, on the contrary, build a guard force consisting of 100,000 men who will support the National Socialist movement and the racialist idea. Chapter 10. The Mask of Federalism. In the winter of 1919, and more so in the spring and summer of 1920, the Young Party was forced to take a position on a question which was greatly significant during the war. In the first volume, I described briefly the symptoms I saw which foretold the threatening German collapse, and I discussed the propaganda that was being spread by the English and French in order to tear open the old gap between North and South Germany. Back in the spring of 1915, the first organized pamphlet campaign was started, which was designed to inflame feelings against Prussia by labeling it as the one and only party who was guilty of starting the war. This propaganda system was developed and perfected little by little until the year 1916, and it was as clever as it was wicked. The effort to prod the South Germans and turn them against the North Germans using their lowest level desires began to bear fruit quickly. the government deserves a firm reprimand, as well as the army, and especially the Bavarian leaders, for their failure to act and at least attempt to counter this propaganda. This guilt of failure is inescapable. They should have acted. Because they forgot to do their duty, they failed to stop this propaganda with the necessary determination. In fact, nothing was done. In various government positions, they did not even appear to look at this propaganda as a problem. Maybe they were stupid enough to think that this propaganda would somehow build unity among the German people and bring them closer to national unification. And at the same time, somehow, the German state powers would automatically be strengthened too. Rarely in history has a malicious neglect been more maliciously avenged. The enemy planned to only weaken Prussia, but their propaganda struck all of Germany. The consequence was the acceleration of the collapse, which devastated Germany and the individual states themselves. Against one particular city, the manufactured hatred towards Prussia was stirred up the most violently, and that was where the revolution against the ancestral royal house first broke out. It would be wrong to think this anti-Prussian feeling was exclusively due to the hostile war propaganda, or that those who fell for it could not be forgiven. The absolutely insane organization of our wartime economy centralized all of the production resources in one area, and that one area not only represented the entire realm, it swindled the Reich, and this was mostly why anti-Prussian sentiment grew so strong. The normal man on the street viewed the companies that handled war production as having their headquarters in Berlin. Those profiteers were identical with Berlin, and to him, Berlin was synonymous with Prussia. The organizers of this predatory institution of the war profiteers, the so-called war companies, were neither of Berlin nor Prussians, and they were not Germans at all. But this hardly entered the mind of the average person at that time. He only saw the gross failure and the constant encroachments of the hateful financial arrangements from these companies. And it was most pronounced in those who controlled the capital. Of course, he transferred his entire hatred onto the capital of Berlin and thereby to Prussia. This was especially true because the government did nothing to stop it. But instead, this blaming of Berlin was quietly welcomed with a sinister smirk. The Jew was clever enough to see his infamous plunder of the German people, which he organized under the cloak of the war companies, would raise opposition from the public. As long as this opposition did not threaten his throat, he was not afraid of it. To prevent the anger of the rebellious masses from exploding in his own face, there was no better recipe than to let their rage flame up in a different direction, and in this way, he could also use it. Let Bavaria go on fighting against Prussia, and Prussia against Bavaria. The more, the merrier. The more difficult the battle was between these two only meant the more secure peace was for the Jew. The public's attention was completely diverted from the international maggot of the nations, and they seemed to be forgotten completely. If any enlightened people, and there were many in Bavaria, showed a dangerous tendency to advise caution, to seek insight or urge restraint in the embittered struggle, or if there was any threat that the matter would die down, then the Jew in Berlin would provoke the people in a new way and await its success. All of those who profited from the conflict between the North and the South pounced at every opportunity and blew on the flame until the glow sparked to life in a bright fire of revolutionary desire. It was a clever, subtle game that the Jew played. He kept the German people constantly occupied and diverted their attention, which allowed him to steal even more from them. Then came the revolution. Up until November of 1918, the average man, especially the narrow-minded middle class and lower-educated workers, could not yet fully comprehend what was actually going on or the inevitable consequences of the conflict among the German peoples, especially in Bavaria. At least that group, which called itself nationalist, should have been able to comprehend it on the day the revolution broke out. The dust from the revolutionary action hardly had time to settle before the leader and organizer declared himself the representative of Bavarian interests in Bavaria. This international Jew, Kurt Eisner, Marxist premier of Bavaria, began to play Bavaria against Prussia. It was obvious that this valuable gem, who had constantly wandered around Germany as one of the journalistic rabble, would be the last person called upon as a protector of Bavarian interests, and he was completely indifferent whether Bavaria was even part of God's wide world. When Kurt Eisner intentionally gave the revolutionary uprising in Bavaria the appearance of a spear point aimed at Prussia, he did not do this from the standpoint of Bavarian interests, but only as a commissioner of Jewry. He used the instincts and dislikes of the Bavarian people in order to more easily break up Germany. He knew the divided nation would easily become the booty of Bolshevism. His tactics continued to be used even after his death. Marxism bathed the individual states and their princes in Germany in the bloodiest mockery. But then they turned around and suddenly called themselves an independent party, and they appealed to those feelings and instincts among the families of princes and the individual German states. The struggle of the Bavarian Soviet Republic against the advancing liberation troops sent by the German government was publicized through Marxist propaganda as a struggle of Bavarian workers against Prussian militarism. This claim is the only way we can understand why the overthrow of the Marxist Republic of Councils in Munich was so different from other German regions. In Munich, the overthrow of the Soviet Republic did not lead to the masses recovering their senses, but it caused an even greater bitterness and resentment toward Prussia. The Bolshevik troublemakers understood how to make the defeat of the Bavarian Soviet Republic look like it was a Prussian military victory against the anti-Prussian-minded Bavarian people, and they had great results because the campaign was highly effective. Kurt Eisner did not even have 10,000 followers in the Munich legislative elections, and the Communist Party had less than 3,000 supporters. However, after the collapse of the Bavarian Soviet Republic, both political parties together had risen to approximately 100,000 voters. At this time, my personal struggle against the insane provocation of one group of German people against another began. I don't think I have ever in my life taken on a campaign that was more unpopular than my opposition to the harassment of Prussia at that time. In Munich, the first mass assemblies had already taken place during the Bavarian Soviet Republic period. The hatred against the rest of Germany, especially against Prussia, was whipped up to such a boiling point that it was possible a visitor from North Germany who made the mistake of attending such a meeting might be killed. Such demonstrations usually concluded with open, insane shouts, "Free from Prussia! Down with Prussia! War against Prussia!" This was a mood which an especially brilliant representative of Bavarian sovereign interests in the German Reichstag summed up in the battle cry, "I would rather die a Bavarian than rot a Prussian." You would have to experience the meetings back then to truly understand what it meant for me to go to a gathering for the first time in the Löwenbräu cellar in Munich and warn those attending about this craziness when I was surrounded by only a handful of war comrades who were willing to stand by me. You must remember that the people in this crazy mob are the same ones who wandered around as deserters. They were the ones who shirked responsibility in army bases or hung around at home during that time when we were out defending the fatherland. So you can understand our feelings when this irrational mob yelled at us and threatened to kill us. These appearances did have some positive benefits. The band of my faithful followers soon felt strongly bound to me for the first time and swore allegiance to me through life and death. These battles were repeated over and over throughout the whole year of 1919, and they seemed to increase in violence after 1920. I remember one meeting especially well. It was in Wagner Hall in Munich. My group, which had grown much larger by then, had to endure very serious fights that often ended in the mistreatment of dozens of my followers who were beaten, kicked, and finally thrown out of the halls, more dead than alive. The battle that I started by myself, back when I was supported only by my war companions, was now continued by the young movement as a holy mission. At that time, we were forced to rely almost exclusively on our Bavarian supporters. However, I am proud to be able to say today that we slowly but surely put an end to this mixture of stupidity and treason. I say stupidity and treason because I cannot give the organizers and instigators credit for being simple-minded. However, I am convinced their believers are really good-natured but stupid followers. I considered and still consider those organizers to be traitors, even to this day. They were hired and paid for by France. In the case of Dorton, history has already passed judgment. What made this movement especially dangerous was the clever way they concealed their real motives by pushing the Federalist intentions to the forefront, claiming it was their only motive. It is obvious that the stirring up of hatred against Prussia has nothing to do with federalism. A federative activity that attempts to dissolve or divide another state in the federation at best seems unusual. A genuine federalist who honestly quotes Bismarck's concept of the empire could not, in the same breath, want to separate parts from the Prussian state created by, or at least perfected by, Bismarck, or even openly support such separatist efforts. They would have shouted in Munich if a Prussian conservative party had favored or openly promoted the independence of Franconia, northern part of Bavaria, from Bavaria. One could only feel sorry for the genuine federalist-minded people who did not see through this reprehensible swindle. They were the first ones who were deceived. By allowing the Federalist idea to be twisted to such an extent, its own supporters were actually digging their own graves.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.